Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
That's the start point of transformational leadership, is to go, you know what? I can fight this. I can make it worse. I can do all sorts of things. Or you can metabolize it.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
Welcome to the show today. So excited to introduce you to our guest. He is brilliant. We were joking about whether that should be in quotes, parentheses, or whatnot, but after you take a look at his book, I'm sure you will agree. Our guest today is Nick Jankel, who's a highly sought after and accomplished international professional keynote speaker. He has served organizations around the world as a futurist, a transformation catalyst, and he's at the pinnacle of his thought leadership, and you'll see why as we get to talking. He's advised and accelerated ambitious organizations like Google, Diageo, Intel, Lendlease, P&G, and even the BBC. I mean, you can't get any bigger and institutional than the BBC, and when you hear his voice, you might understand why he was talking with the BBC. Nick, welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Thank you so much, David. We actually call affectionately the BBC Auntie in the UK, which sort of brings not the funky Auntie either. I think the sort of one that likes to sip a little bit of sherry on the corner.
Well, I got to tell you, anybody who can be an advisor to their Auntie, that is the pinnacle of thought leadership. I think that is what it looks like.
That's the pinnacle of emotional courage. That's for sure.
That's right.
I think, as you know from my book, emotional wisdom and thought leadership definitely go together, I think, in today's world. But no, they're amazing. Actually, the BBC are an amazing organization, and they're much maligned by everyone who likes to take a shot. But they've actually done some incredible things for our world and our planet, and continue to do. So I'm very proud of having worked with them for many years on many different things.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. Well, I'm excited to have you here because we're going to be talking about your latest book out this year with very current, relevant information. It's called Now Lead the Change, Repurpose Your Career, Future-Proof Your Organization, and Regenerate Our Crisis-Hit World by Mastering Transformational Leadership. So you can see in that subtitle as you're listening today, very practical, very applicable for this moment. But before we dive into the book, Nick, I want to ask you to go back with us to your earliest memory of yourself as a leader. What would that be?
I'll use one that I actually brought to life in a previous book. When I was 15, and it's only in the benefit of 2020 hindsight that one does, you know, 30 years later, realize the stepstones of your story. I was invited to give a sermon in a synagogue to celebrate a graduation of all the 15-year-olds of that group. So it's a couple of years after Bar Mitzvah, and we'd all done 2 years of kind of like an academic program in religion, you know, the government exam. This was kind of like the graduation. They invited me to be the sermon speaker, which is the first time I'd ever really done public speaking. And I had never wanted to be a speaker or you know, anything. I didn't know it wasn't a thing really in England in 1980s, late 80s. And they invited me to do that. And so that was the first time I realized I was being invited to speak for a group, to speak on behalf of a group, and to bring the group along with me into a conversation, you know, pulling from them some ideas. It wasn't just the Me Show. And I think I guess at around that time I was attempting to influence groups of kids, you know, teenage boys, 15, 16 year old boys, away from some of the more harmful, diminishing, destabilizing things that boys can do. And I think I was also probably learning that my parents needed to be led in some way to understand me and where I was going from the homes we had. So I think that's probably the glimmers of realization. But I didn't really think of leadership as a concept. I didn't have it as a meme or a term until way later, like in my late 20s. That's when I sort of understood leadership was a sector, not an industry, but a topic, you know, a genre of its own.
Something you could learn and study. And so, yeah. So one of your earliest memories is really of influence, is of being an influencer to your peers, mm-hmm. to your own parents. And so that's a journey that started pretty early in life for you.
Yes. Although I don't think I was given much guidance. And I think one of the things I look back on and go, how many teenagers are out there who, given some leadership technologies, some tools, some an overview of where you could go as a leader. So I tried to do in this book, actually give a little bit of a sort of, where can you go with this kind of stuff? How much more amazing our world will be actually, and how much less pain and suffering there would be. I mean, obviously it's changed. We do have now programs for young leaders, both in companies, but also in schools. There is a lot more active interest in what a leader of tomorrow looks like. So I am kind of more hopeful. But it's definitely something very passionate to me, which is how do you bring leadership out of people at any age, in any sector, in any class, gender, color, whatever. As I say in the book, leadership is a human skill, not a technical skill. And you don't have to wait to be called a leader, you know, tier three or whatever, you know, pay code X1, I don't know, whatever these corporate terms are. You don't have to wait to then to be a leader. You can be one much quicker.
Absolutely. A topic near and dear to our heart on this show. So before we go into the book, Nick, I want to ask you to tell our listeners just a little bit about your journey and how you got from the work that you were doing, and you were all over the world, corporate jets, all that fun stuff, to what you're working on now.
I'll give you so I started my career in medical school, actually, and I wanted to be a psychiatrist, psychologist, and followed some, you know, these sort of, what do you call them, little breadcrumbs. Followed some breadcrumbs. Ended up in an ad agency, a big ad agency, beautiful, amazing ad agency. It kind of peaked time for ads, and was essentially a consumer psychologist, creative strategist, brand thinker, sort of applying the psychology of humans into corporate world. And I ended up starting my own company very early in my life, around 24. So that, first of all, made me have to step up massively, and I started learning a lot about the more sort of self-development coaching side of things. So I had a coach almost immediately at 24, entrepreneurial coach. And the company was all about doing innovation. It was an innovation consultancy, innovation agency. And what two things started happening. One, I started realizing that clients could have all the innovation ideas and beautiful designs and business model designs and whatever they wanted. If they didn't have the leadership capacity to land them in the organization and take the organization with them, they just stayed in the beautiful, you know, PowerPoint slides that we gave them, the renders or whatever. And that was actually quite heartbreaking for me to do, you know, spend 2 years in investigating the future of a sector, and like blood, sweat and tears and creative workshops and consumer insights and anthropological stuff, just to find that the company didn't have the culture, the leadership culture. And at the same time, I was also being asked by clients, could you teach us how to do this stuff? Can you teach us creativity? Can you teach us innovation, process, disruptive innovation? And that became creative leadership, obviously. And then my early interest in my personal change, psychology, psychiatry, then returned into my kind of field very explicitly, consciously. And I realized that I wanted to deliver a leadership framework or approach that was rigorous, that wasn't just influenced by a fancy trend. If I'm going to use some neuroscience, I want to actually know the paper that I'm quoting. That's the old rigor of being a scientist originally. And that sort of, you know, grew over time. And then I brought in, I guess, a more personal aspect, a more purposeful, more spiritual aspect myself, as I grew myself through the maturity levels of the natural progress of me. And then I guess that's all sort of come together finally in the last maybe 2 or 3 years. But it's been obviously a very, I wouldn't call it a neat transition. There was no talent pipeline for me. There was no coach. There was no mentor. There was just me struggling, working it out, unfolding some stuff, having some colleagues that have helped me, or peers. So that's kind of like a little bit of the journey. So I didn't want to do this. It wasn't something I thought, I want to be a leadership consultant. It kind of found me. And obviously you can see there a nice little circle. 15, wanted to be a psychiatrist. Not quite 50, but almost 50, ending up being a kind of leadership, I wouldn't call it psychiatrist is the wrong term, but psychiatry means healing of the soul, which fits nicely with your, for this podcast title, right? So there is something about the soul of leadership, which is an important aspect to it.
Well, and it's one of the reasons I asked you to share that background is so that as we're talking, people understand where you're coming from. It's one of the things that attracted me to your work is that you are very grounded. You've got your own experiences, your own observations, but then also the data, the research. Let's talk about how the brain actually works. I mean, you've got all of it there. And for any leader that wants to make a practical transformational difference, you want to know these things. You don't need to necessarily be a neuroscientist and have that level of expertise, but a basic understanding of the functioning of human beings is going to help you to bring the most out of them, to help them become their best self. Let's dive into the book. When you talk about now lead change, now lead the change, and you talk about all the things that you just brought to bear, I can't think of a more important time to be having these discussions. I mean, you talk about a digital, disrupted, damaged world. So let's just start there. Let's start with the problem as if we aren't all living it, but how would you diagnose the state of affairs right now?
I just love the way you said that, as if we're not all living it. When I started writing the book, I knew we were all living it, but most people didn't know that we were all living it. You know, we're just sitting around with our business model. It's all nice. And now the last few months, we are now living what a futurist or someone with foresight can see is already occurring, but it's now become mainstream. We're now sort of like in the early mainstream of adopting this digital disrupted damaged world. So let me just give you the three D's. I like to alliterate. I like to organize my thoughts because as you can see from the book, I've got so many sources of information coming into me and into the book. I need for myself to be sane. I need to be able to organize it at least in some kind of way. And I'd like to, you know, quote Einstein, simple, but not simplistic, because our brains can't cope with too many inputs and numbers and diagrams and stuff. So the three things, I think you can pretty put much everything that's happening into these three boxes are digital, which means essentially most interestingly, exponential digital technologies, technologies that can scale an idea from 1 to 50 million in a few weeks, months. And within that, we've got these so-called fourth industrial revolution technologies, which are coming online only just really now. AI, machine learning, blockchain, they're all just the beginnings of these things. I mean, we don't even know what they're going to do yet. They're just sort of popping in, but they really are changing everything. Not always for the better, as we can tell from some of the, what I would call the outrage algorithms of social media, sort of fanning the flames of our not better angels, our diablos inside, our trolls, flaming our trolls, our inner trolls. So that's the digital aspect. And pretty much, I mean, this has been said for many years by Silicon Valley, but if your business model doesn't somehow use digital technologies, whether it's through Zoom or literally an app or something, it's out of date already, let alone 5 to 10 years from now. So, you know, so really got engaged with that. But actually there's a bigger issue or disruptor to our status quo business as usual, which is what I call sort of generational disruption, generational change, in that a 22-year-old now has such a different worldview to a 62-year-old in terms of what they need and as values. And most of our business models are oriented towards an older customer because that's just who was around 10 years ago or 20 years ago with money. I mean, something like $8 out of every $10 is owned by a baby boomer. But that's obviously changing quickly because they're retiring and also dying, if we're, you know, to be clear and honest. And then the third, so that's the second D, disruption. And the third D is damaged world, which again has been something that maybe the sustainability people dealing with, I don't know, maybe they are, maybe they're not, CSR, someone should deal with it, but it's not really to do with the business. And now we've got pollution killing people. We've got fires all over the place, including all around Silicon Valley and LA, places I've lived and love. You've got polar ice melting. You've got a pandemic, which is sitting up upon already fractured, damaged world. And perhaps maybe the biggest one is you've got political instability and identity crises that are just tearing us apart. I mean, we're really in a pickle. So those are the three Ds. And I think everything fits into those three Ds. And our job as leaders is to interrogate and engage with these three fundamental, they're not trends. They're like, I call them drivers of change or drivers of transformation. And we have to find our way through them. And that's really the sort of start point of the book and what transformation leadership needs to dance with.
As you bring those up, right towards the end, you were going someplace that I think needs to be highlighted. And you've got it's a thread throughout the book, but you've got a whole chapter about it. And that is that what leaders do, if you're going to use the word leader, and regardless of your title, as you said earlier, with a capital L,
yeah,
you're going to lead. You have got to look reality in the face and react to it in a transformational, in a positive way. And you call that the leadership invitation. You've got I think it's chapter 14 that you talk about.
Yes.
Invite us, give us this invitation. Because one of the things I appreciate, this is a smack in the face to me. If you're just sitting back like there's some reality here. Talk to us about that.
Well, I mean, the pandemic is a great example of this, right? Because it's a slap in the face. It was a slap in the face. And I think most people are still feeling this, the cheek. No one wants to deal with it. We don't want to wear masks. We don't want to have a lockdown. We want to just get on with our lives. But actually, sorry, that's not happening. And people are still resisting it. And one of the start points of leadership, and particularly for me, in the journey of leadership that we talk about in the book and teach, it starts with conscious leadership, which is sort of level one of six levels. And level one is, how am I showing up? Am I resisting reality? Am I catastrophizing it more than it already is? Am I dramatizing reality, or am I denying it, or what am I doing? And so that's like the first start point with the invitation, which is whatever is happening around you, it's an invitation, or you can see it as a threat. Really, they are both equally accurate. I mean, this has been said in every self-help book for 100 years. Henry Ford, a problem is an opportunity in work clothes, right? So that's the start point of transformational leadership, is to go, you know what, I can fight this, I can make it worse, I can do all sorts of things, or, and this is where I use this word a lot, as you know from the book, or you can metabolize it. And this is a really important word for me, because in biology, when a cell takes in food, which is what we need, it has to do something to that food. It can't just sit with it. It metabolizes it. And I think a business, any business, an organization, a community group, whatever your entity is, really agnostic, a group of people called a business or enterprise or organization can take in change that's happening if they want to, through semi-permeable membranes. And within the sort of cell goo of our enterprises, we can turn that into value, which brackets all businesses are here to create value. All political parties are here to create value. All charities are here, or nonprofits are here to create value. So then that's the beginning. That's the invitation. Take this thing inside you, literally inside you, inside your mind and your heart, and go away and think about it and reflect on it and do whatever you're going to do with it. And then bring it into your enterprise and say, guys, we have to engage in this. And it's not going to go away. Let's adapt. And then something I didn't put in the book, but I've been thinking a lot about, and it's maybe a future book or something. In evolutionary theory, they people talk about pre-adaptations. So these are adaptations that become more valuable when the ecosystem changes, but they were already kind of developed. So you can see Zoom was pre-adapted for a pandemic. It had already seen the writing on the wall and was already adapted, as was Amazon and Facebook and all the big tech companies, mas o menos. And I think that's where this invitation really is whether this stuff is not hitting you right this second. And actually, you know, you're doing fine. You know, obviously, if you're a cinema or a movie house, that's not the case. But if you are, I don't know, selling online fashion, you're probably doing all right now. But that doesn't mean it's going to last that long or forever. So what can you bring inside you? And I actually make this live right now. As you're listening to this, what is staring at you in the face that hasn't fully accepted or embraced as an opportunity for transformation? And what would happen if you right now brought it inside your consciousness to work on And you might not succeed and you might have not have a major innovation for it. That's not the point. The point is bring it inside and let your consciousness, which is the most incredibly powerful organizing system in the universe, the most incredibly powerful, let it get to work and see what it can untangle from the future that's rushing towards us.
And you give leaders some particularly helpful ways to ask those questions and figure that out in their organizations. And I liked the questions. And when you get into triple loop learning and talking about that, it's a way to process all of this and
right.
ask ourselves the questions that, because if I'm a leader, I'm sitting there going, okay, yeah, I've got a job to do and I've got this team to lead and I got results I got to accomplish. And how do I deal with the massiveness of the global change that Nick's talking about? Mm. That, yes, I'm feeling and dealing with, but I need to localize that down to
definitely
my sphere, what I can do, impact, what I can do and where I can influence. And so I thought triple loop learning was a particularly helpful way to think about that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I borrowed it from another thinker who is now deceased, I believe, who talked about double loop learning. So the first two loops are, what has this project right now in the micro geographic moment of this moment, what has this project taught me about how to do the next project better? So whatever that is, whether you're doing a marketing campaign, an email newsletter today, whatever you're doing today, what have you learned in the last week, month that you would teach the next person who does this or write on your best practice document, should you have one, how to do it better? That's the first loop. The second loop is, what is this project, particularly the failures on the project, taught us about our business model, our product or service or our proposition, whatever your proposition is. And this is the one most people don't want to do because it often means questioning everything you're doing right now. And was it right? It doesn't mean you have to do anything about it. You could just park it on a, you know, a spreadsheet, on a Google sheet, on a, on Slack, or send it to people, or do it at your next away day, virtual or not. What did this tell us about an early warning signal about somewhere where our business model is not fitting the world? And I would suggest to you, if you're listening to this, that in every single part of your business organization, there are things that don't fit right now. And they're probably not a big deal right now, but they might be a big deal sooner than you think. And you can't solve all of them, but where are you getting sort of a sense that there's definitely something that needs updating, changing? That's the second loop. The third loop is really us as leaders of a world in pain, which is, what does my failure on my micro project tell me about my enterprise's business model mismatching, but tells us about how our system is no longer a fit for purpose for ourselves or our grandchildren? And that's the third loop. You know, what is not working? You know, why am I flying to do a keynote, you know, 5,000 miles away, using up all this car? You know, let me think about that. You know, that's something to think about. So that's the triple loop of learning. And obviously you can't do it all the time. No one can. But one of the things I talk about in the book, and I often finish a keynote with this, because obviously keynotes, people go, well, how do I do all this? How do I change everything? And I'm like, read my book, you know, buy a program, something. I can't give you the answer in 10 seconds. What I can say to you is, do one thing. And I have a few of these, but one of the things I always say to people is, spend half an hour in the next week, schedule it into your diary now. So if you're listening, do that. What I call reflect and connect, or connect and reflect. Take something that is not working in your business and just sit with it in a place of openness, relaxation, after a shower, after a run, after a yoga class, whatever, and just let your being, let your mind and heart just wrap itself around it and unpack it a little bit. It almost invariably opens up possibilities. It's just that one act. And most of us have value engineered out all the reflection time out of our lives, particularly if you're a manager / leader. And that's something I really believe that leaders need to build back in, is regular time to reflect on your challenges.
And it's not just something you believe. You made a statement in the book. I can't recall which chapter or page it was on, but I mean, it was a lot more forceful than, yeah, well, I believe it. It's like, listen, you're not reflecting. You're not thinking about these things. You're not leading.
Wow. Okay. That's great. I'm glad I was more clear.
Paraphrasing in my emotional truth of what you said, Nick, that's the way it struck me.
I'm about to take that one for a Facebook post. I quite like it. Whether I wrote it or not, if you're not reflecting, you're not leading. But I definitely, if something doesn't have to change, there's no need for leadership. Just have management. Manage the hell out of that model. Tweak it. Make it better. Increase the efficiency outputs. Boom, job done. But we don't live in that world anymore. And that's the thing that I think is so exciting / terrifying for us all. And I, you know, there are moments I wake up at 3 in the morning, you know, if I haven't done my reflecting and processing time, because my body wakes me up to reflect and process. I made that deal with myself a few years ago. I'm like, you know, if I'm not doing the work, wake me up and I'll do it at 3 a.m. No matter how innovative your organization is, there's always things that are not fitting because the world's changing faster than we can even comprehend in our, you know, we can't even deal with it, right? Even since March, I mean, how much of our lives have changed? And that's not just from the pandemic, that's from other things too. We have to somehow do two things. And this is one of the big points of the book, is we have to keep stability for ourselves and others, because no one likes the boss that's always changing everything and reinventing every wheel and designing a new, you know, sliced bread. You know, no one wants that. But we also have to be really agile and go, you know what, we're going to really reinvent this, you know, I don't know, whatever it is you do today or this week. And somehow we have to keep this stability thing done. And that can't come from our business model, because that's not, can't be stable anymore. It has to be agile. It has to come from something else. There are clues in the book where you can find that stability. And then you also have to be agile. And we have to constantly know when to back out away from agility and when to lean into agility.
So I want to dive into this a little bit deeper, because listeners of the show will recognize that dichotomy that you just illustrated there for us. In courageous cultures, the way we talk about it is the elegant dance between clarity and curiosity.
Right.
And, yeah. And I like alliteration too. The, you know, that... That we need both. And so yes. You have a fantastic way of talking about these inclinations that are in all of us.
Yes.
To control and protect and create and connect.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes. I get confused myself sometimes.
Control and protect, create and connect.
Yes.
And I'm just going to turn you loose on this concept because okay. I think it'll be practically helpful for people.
It's probably my most useful thing that I've ever discovered. Invented. And I teach this to my kids, where we call it closed open or control collaborate. You know, we teach, my kids are 8 and 11 at the moment. So we're teaching them these two inclinations, two mindsets. I teach it to, you know, senior execs all over the world. So control and protect mode is the one that most of us are most familiar with, because it's what's been trained and rewarded in us for the last X number of years. As soon as you go to school, not, you know, not kindergarten, it's all fun and games, but as soon as you get 7, 8, 9, people are like, stop being curious and, you know, inefficient. Here's some answers, learn them, there's going to be a test. And that's the beginning of the amazing strength of control and protect mode. So control and protect has got two functions, obviously. Control the crazy, control the chaos of life, control our parents, control the remote control, control life by getting stuff done, use Google Sheets, use Excel, whatever. We're good at that, most of us. And then protect is, there's a threat I'm going to defend using something I've done in the past. So control and protect mode essentially learns algorithms, and it learns rules for dealing with life and getting stuff done and making some money and being safe and being rewarded and applauded and getting some promotions, whatever. Wonderful. That's for what I call generally the world of management. It's not exactly that neat, but we can just put that for now. And every business needs managers, and I need to be a manager regularly. I need to inhabit control and protect mode with my kids, with my staff, with clients, with myself. But if that's all we've got, we have no way of being creative and collaborative and creative, you know, curious, compassionate, caring, all the C's that we love. And so create and connect mode is equally natural, equally inbuilt. And these actually, by the way, do fit into brain research and brain network research of the last 5-10 years. So that was really when I was like, wow, this is actually occurring in networks in our brain, not just in my own sort of frame thinking. And so create and connect mode does two things. It does creativity, innovation, new thoughts, possibility, divergent thinking. And then the connect part is it does empathy, it does insight. And of course, you need insight to create ideas about the world, innovations, we call them. You need insight into customers, and particularly future customers, emerging customers. And so these two modes are beautiful because they're always available to us. And in fact, the latest research shows that people who are highly innovative are able to activate both networks very quickly. Here's an idea, let's judge the idea. Here's another idea, let's get rid of that idea. Here's another idea, let's execute that idea by 3 o'clock this afternoon because I want to take some time off to go and reflect, for example. So that's what I guess is the key to leadership, is being able to know what mode you're in, which is a revelation for a lot of people is that that's even two and what it feels like. And you can start to build a real sense of, oh, when I feel this thing in my chest, I think I know I'm in protect. Okay, good, good to know. Then obviously we want to be able to use the right mode for the moment, and then we need to be able to shift between the modes, which is easier said than done, obviously, but that's really the key to life is, how do I use the right moment for the problem? And in my keynotes, I often put up a picture of a busy, I used to live in LA, so I'm gonna talk about the 405 highway. Some of you will know it. The joke is, it's called that because you can only go 4 or 5 miles an hour. So the 405, 6 lanes or 10 lanes in some places, both sides, you do not want to be in crane connect mode crossing this thing. You just want to get across using all the tools that have been drilled into you by your auntie to get across the road. However, if you want to solve climate change or future-proof your business model, don't be in that mode where you know everything and you're right and you've got all the answers because you're the genius CEO in the center of the room. Everyone's, you know, kowtowing to you. You want to be in the absolute opposite place, which is, I don't know the answer. Let's go on a journey together. Let's be curious. Let me ask this 20-year-old because they seem to know a lot about blockchain. And if you're a sustainability director, don't go into freaky fear and worry no matter how much you've got, because people will just go into control and protect mode. So the great tragicomedy of life, and I've seen it in every workshop, every business meeting, is we go into the wrong mode for the moment. And that's the leader's job, more than anyone else's in that room, is to make sure you are holding a space for whichever mode is appropriate. And that includes not just what you say, but how do you show up with your body and your eyes and your all these muscles that communicate volumes to people, the sweat or not that you're having because you're freaking out on the inside, all that people can pick up, and that will shift them quicker than your words. We must be innovative, you know. So that's the sort of top skate along the modes, which are very generative once you go deeper into them and understand them more.
Such a useful model, and one I hope that if you're listening, you'll rewind and listen to that rewind. I guess, you know, go back. It tells you my age, right? And let's go back and listen to that again. And particularly, Nick, I appreciate the focus on the leader's role in all of that, because to hold that space, A, to identify what mode should we be in here? Is this a clarity? Is this a control and protect? Or should we be in that curiosity, create, connect? Should we be in that frame? And then to hold that space. Mm. I'm going to fast forward, and I hope that listeners get this book, get Nick's book, invest in this, and it's going to pay off for you. But I want to take us to one of the later chapters, which I think elaborates a little bit on what you were just getting at, and that's emotional safety.
Mm.
Both the role, why this concept is so important from a leadership perspective, and then how do we go about establishing it?
I mean, when this term emotional safety or psychological safety became sort of popped in leadership circles a couple of years ago or whenever it was such a helpful thing for people who do this kind of work, because it created a language and a sort of, Harvard Business Review approval of something we'd all known for a long time, which is, for example, when you're running an innovation workshop, you have to do two things. You have to get the process design right. You really do. You've got to get tools and process that get you through these difficult, creative, open possibility moments. But you, more importantly, you have to hold space. So the word we use in this industry, you have to hold space for people to change, to have ideas, to feel like, not just, there's two parts, I think, to being psychological safety or emotional safety, holding space. One is you've got to help people, the safe part. You have to have them feel, not just hear from you, but feel in their body emotionally, more important than thoughts, that you can have a crazy idea, a dumb idea, a wacky idea, and you can try something that no one's done before, and it may not work, and we may not give you a raise because of it, but we won't punish you by all the different forms of punishment we know how to do. We learned from our caregivers and aunties and uncles theme today for me. They have to feel that you won't do that. And that, by the way, in nice companies, and most companies I work for are nice and sort of collegial and democratic, but they still have ways of punishing people. Classic one is, have you really thought that through? Which is basically a demeaning, devaluing, diminishing statement. So emotional safety is when someone knows that they can try something out, they can speak their mind about your business model, about the holy cows of your business right down to actually, I think the logo should be moved left on that social media post. You may not think it's brilliant and you may not think, you know, give them loads of kudos and props, but you won't punish them for it. You'll go, thank you, that's interesting. Or as a headmistress of one of the schools my kids went to, everything's a contribution, which is a really important thought of psychological safety. Because then what it does is it does two things. One, it allows people to actually share, and you want them to share, you want them to bring these ideas up. One of the things I often say in a keynote is, do you really think no one at Kodak ever thought, this is not going well for us? Do you think they all just was towing the line? No, of course not. They just didn't say anything. Nokia is the same. I use that example in the book. If people are scared, not even being fired, it's being disapproved of. Mm-hmm. They won't share these critical challenges to your thinking. You don't need to do market research, you know, 20 focus groups in five markets. You don't need to do that because you've got people in there from your target market if they can speak. That's the first thing. It helps with the learning, triple loop learning. But more than that, and this is where the deeper level of holding space comes from, they don't just feel safe. They then actually tap into their own creative flow state and their own channel, if you want to use that term. It's a difficult term for me to use, but I will use it. They tap into their own channel, their own creative force, their own intuitive genius, and from their mouths drop the pearls that we want to collect up and build into another product, project, service, whatever. So you both guard against being disrupted and you allow for your own disruption to your own market, your own self-disruption. But it only happens with safety, and it only happens, there's more than, I talk about trust and, you know, reciprocity. There are other things that go on in a team that I think work beyond safety, but that's like the bottom. That's like the sine qua non, if you want a bit of Latin, without which nothing of agility, transformation, all these things. And it's tricky because most of the leaders I work with cognitively get it, not dumb. And they think they're good people, and they are good people. And they're probably, you know, of my generation, they're kind of with it. They're cool dads and mums who wear, you know, cool jeans or whatever, and trainers and whatever, but they're behaving in ways that are embedded. I call them in the book pernicious and persistent protective patterns. And they are showing up in a way that is having people not feel safe, whilst knowing that safety, reading the book on safety, you know, psychology.
And nodding the whole time and going, yes. So we see that all the time. So in our approach in Courageous Cultures, we talk about behaviorally, that fundamental behavior that you just discussed is, for us, it's respond with regard. So if there is a need for more information, if they haven't thought it fully through, we don't have to demean. We can say, thank you so much for thinking about how we can improve. You know, here's some information that will help as you're fleshing out that idea. You know, here's a priority you might not have been aware of. And then an invitation, would love to get your thoughts on how we might solve for this. You know, give them the information they need to think strategically. That's a fundamental shift in behavior for most of us. I know I wasn't brought up that way. And I have rarely ever met a leader who has, but with all the intentions we set and all the pronouncements we make and all the initiatives we start, those are all a start. The closing of the loop is how we actually respond. And so I'm so glad that you bring that out, because if we're not acting that way, all of the intentions are for naught.
And just, as you said that, I was just putting my own lens on my own team. You know, it's easy to talk about this to other people and teach them. And what one of the things that one realizes when you hear this idea of what did you, something regard, positive regard. I mean,
respond with people, regard.
Yeah, people talk about in psychotherapy, unconditional positive regard as the key to holding for a child. So I love that, respond with regard. And what it does is it takes time. You have to slow down. And that's basically the rub. Because we can all do that. We can all say, actually, I'd love to hear your timetable, 10 minutes next week, da, da, da. But you have to then slow it down enough to not just go, we did that last year, it didn't work, sorry, thanks, goodbye. You have to go, interesting. And here's some, as you said, here's some developmental feedback. Here's a frame that you probably haven't thought of through the lens of this or lens of that. Maybe I haven't supported you enough and didn't give you a better briefing. That's one of the big things I talk about. Give better briefings and you'll get a lot better outputs at the end, and take the time to slow down and think, what does this person need to know that I've got from my experience and genius that will help them have a better outcome that I won't then bitch and moan about afterwards, which is so nice to do. We all do it. Did I have to do everything myself? And, you know, I've been an entrepreneur for 21 years, so I know that one really well. It's always because I don't spend enough time. You know, there are other reasons. I can't control someone else's learning, experience, knowledge, genius, but I know I can control the briefing and the time I take. And yet, you know, we're busy. So how do we square?
Well, like so many of these other power skills that we're talking about from a leadership perspective, the investment we make here is a massive amount of time gained or productivity gained or what have you down the road, but it's making it now and being aware of those trade-offs to have that discipline. I mean, that's what I appreciate. Going back to something you said early in our conversation, that's what leadership is all about.
It is. Because,
you know, if everyone's doing it and it's the cultural norm, okay, great. Doesn't take as much individual initiative or courage if that's what we're all doing, but someone's got to go first.
Right. And as you say it, there's something else. So just bringing back those modes again, right? So coaching, development, briefing, giving people lenses, that's all creating connect mode, fully engaged with people and empathic. And it only works long-term if those people also have boundaries and aren't in their own patterning around entitlement or leaving every 6 months to another job, because you can't develop, there's no point developing them or putting that energy in if they are essentially in a transactional relationship with you as a company or as a boss, which is a two-way street. And one of the things that we find very challenging is having people stay long enough to have those deeper learnings that we can bring them into if they put in the time, if they pay their dues. And there is a developmental stage. I put in the book these five stages of leadership. And often younger people want to skip a couple. I don't want to do the just learning how to execute. I don't want to do all just learning how to take ownership of a project. I just want to get onto the cool innovation and leadership stuff that you're doing. Where, you know, show you where to go. And, you know, I'm very lucky for myself that I paid those dues. You know I had enough responsibility at a young age to know you can't, there are charlatans definitely in the industry that I'm in, but it's not the path for me. I wanted to really ground my knowledge in actual doing, you know.
And it's important for us as leaders to have those conversations with those young people, because there's nothing wrong with their ambition or desire to make an impact, but to just say, right, well, you need more time, that's frustrating. Mm-hmm. But to say, here are the skills and experience, right, and here are the things that's going to allow you to do, is once you can do this unconsciously, then you're going to have, you know, to have those conversations and help people understand what they should be acquiring so that they can get there as quickly as they want to, if their interest and their desire is sincere.
Which sometimes it isn't, because often people want something that they actually, when they get it, are like, oh God, this is what leadership is. That's a lot. I don't want to do that anymore. Let me just go back and do my day job, because that was actually really easy. And I got it. And at 5 o'clock, I went home. I was not thinking about it anymore. And that's one of the things actually that I counter to this trend to have flat structures and distributed power and creativity at the edges and holacracies and whatever. So a lot of people don't want to have big, strategic, innovative, leadershipy thoughts all the time at 3 a.m. as well. You know, they want to just do their job and go. So that's great. But then just be honest about your own remit and aspirations for life. But this is actually partly an issue with school, is it doesn't give people a framework for where they could go. And most HR departments don't have a kind of up-to-date set of qualities and capabilities for what the job really is, not what the job looks like, but what the job really is, which is a lot of work. And that's a whole other rabbit hole I could.
Well, Nick, I think you and I could go down rabbit holes for them.
We could. There's so many.
The book is called Now Lead the Change. We're talking to Nick Jenkel. Nick, tell us where to find the book and where to find you.
Great. So the book's available, obviously, our dear friend Amazon, and where books are sold. My website, or our website, I should say, is switchonnow.com. And if you go switchonnow.com/leadership, you will get into the stuff we do, the programs we run, you know, the deeper dives, all that kind of stuff. And I'm on all sorts of social media, pretty much. Either look for Switch On or Nick Jenkel, and you'll get me. Twitter, Instagram, whatever your LinkedIn, whatever your preference is, I'm usually there posting something sometimes.
you will find him, and it will be worth your while. I'll tell you what, for fans of the show, you've got Winning Well, you've got Courageous Cultures. Now Lead the Change. we have just scratched the surface. There is so much in terms of the framework Nick provides, the powerful tools you can use to help you be a truly transformational leader, if that's your desire. So I encourage you, get the book, invest, do the work. Each chapter has great questions and ways for you to apply your learning and what you're doing. Nick, it has been an absolute delight talking with you. I'm so glad that we got to have the conversation, because I know that if people will apply everything that they have got today, they're on their way to being the leader they'd want their boss to be.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.